Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. If you like what you hear today, please add a rating and review in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast! Really excited to have James and Suzanne Pileggi-Pawelski on the podcast. James is professor of practice and director of education in the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania, where he co-founded the Master of Applied Positive Psychology program with Martin Seligman. Susie is a freelance writer, Psychology Today blogger, and well-being consultant specializing in the science of happiness and its effects on relationships and health. Together, James and Susie are co-authors of the newly released book, Happy Together, Using the Science of Positive Psychology to Build Love That Lasts. They also give romance and research workshops together around the world, and I've had the pleasure of seeing one of their workshops, and I have to say it's pretty awesome. Hey guys, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks so much for having us, Scott. We're happy to be here.
So great to be with you, Scott.
Yeah, it's really good, and I have so many questions as I was reading this book that I really feel like this can help a lot of people with their relationships. I'm wondering why you guys decided to write this book in the first place.
That's a great question. It seems that in today's culture, there's so much focus on getting together rather than being together. So much focus on finding a perfect person and then on the wedding day, but not much focus on the actual marriage that's intended to last a lifetime. And that's a great question. Well, Scott,
we have the absolute perfect relationship. We have not had any trouble since we, met. And we thought, we should just share our secret sauce with the world and, have everybody learn how it's done. That's a joke. No.
You're human?
We're human. We're absolutely human. And one of the reasons why we wrote this book is to try to dispel this notion of the expectation of the perfect relationship. And so the word perfect actually comes from two Latin words, which means thoroughly done. So no relationship is thoroughly done unless one or both partners stop working at it, right? But we have this pressure in our society, this expectation, this kind of fairy tale approach that we're going to meet the perfect person, the heavens will open, the violins will play, and we will live happily ever after.
I thought that happened when you met me.
Well, of course it did. But this is, for the science of it and the long-term nature of it, it's important to understand that expectation, that feeling of falling in love, it's great, but that's not the whole picture of a romantic relationship. And so there's so many voices in our culture today kind of with that expectation. And I think people then wind up being caught between delight when they feel like they're falling in love and kind of expecting that this will happen, this will continue forever, or despair if they don't get hit by that, that experience or things fall apart in some way.
Yeah, I love that. And that's something that really resonated with me when I saw one of your workshops is just how human and real, this is. You're not trying to paint something that's not attainable. You're trying to paint a real.
Yes. I think we live in an overly curated society, right? And so people are, presenting the best part of themselves out there, understandably. But the last thing we wanted was to write a relationship book which would make people feel worse instead of better, which would make people feel like, we didn't title it, 13 things you need to know for the perfect relationship, or kinds of titles maybe entertaining and kind of interesting and draw you in and entice you to buy the book, but it's just not reality. And so reality, I think, is that relationships are, there's a lot of promise and possibility. There's also a lot of hard work that needs to be rightly directed to be successful.
And it's interesting because it seems that in other aspects of our life, we don't expect to just buy a gym membership and have the a fitter, more toned body overnight, where you don't get that first job and you're going to catapult to the corner office, right? So at the gym, you have to work out, you train for work, you take training classes, and you work at it a lifetime to move up in your career, to get a more flexible and strong body. So why is it when it comes to romantic relationships, long-term relationships, like marriage, do we think you just, find someone, you make all these decisions, you plan a wedding, and then it just happens. Like other aspects of our life, their healthy habits you need to help keep the relationship going and going well, thriving.
Yeah, and you guys coined the term relationship BIM, right?
Yeah, so just like it takes healthy habits and a lifetime of working out to keep your body healthy, same as in a marriage. Like your body changes, you change as an individual, as a couple, you evolve, maybe some things that worked in the beginning, either sometimes they get stale, you know, you fall in a rut, like you do with workouts and you're kind of bored or your body gets used to something and you have to try different routines, some novelty to maintain interest. The same in a marriage or a long-term relationship. What are those healthy exercises you can do? Make an effort to keep it exciting. It doesn't just happen. You got to work together with your partner and come up with ideas and suggestions and activities that work for both of you.
I love that. Okay, so you've pretty much made it clear how this book differs from other books on relationships. So do you feel like that the predominant books that are out there on the topic are kind of unrealistic in what they promise the reader?
I think many of them are unrealistic. I think others are very much focused on problems and how to solve them, which is, of course, important. We all need to know in our lives how to solve the problems that we find in our experience. A problem, though, is that we're a problem with orientation and duly focus our attention on what's not going well in a relationship and forget the things that are going on that are really great about it. And so because, in that initial phase where we fall in love and there's that excitement and so forth, those positive feelings just kind of overwhelm our systems. And we oftentimes think, well, that's the way it's just going to be forever. Things are going to be great. But then the daily grind, day in and day out, you got to set your schedules and you got to figure this out and figure that out. You got to figure out your budget and all that kind of stuff. And then sometimes those annoying things just kind of start to creep in. And because the way we're wired is to be much more sensitive, very sensitive to threat and problems. And so we can tend to focus on, you know, if she would just do that differently or if that, you know, that's a really, this is a perfect relationship, but there's this problem and that can take, it can overridingly occupy our time and focus and attention. And then we can, if we're not careful, forget about the things that are going well. So part of what we're trying to say is that, yes, we do need to have books and you know, it's important to have married therapists, absolutely. It's also, though, important to be balanced about it and to focus at least as much time, we would say, on what's going well in the relationship. And we tend to think that, well, it's going well, so I don't need to think about it. But actually, if something is going well, that's a doorway, it's an option, it's an opportunity to think about that more and to grow it.
And you know, Scott, as a psychologist, obviously, the figure ground concept, I talked about that. Well, I like to talk about what you focus on. So those perceptual things, you know, you talk about if you look at a picture and you can focus on, you know, you see the beautiful woman or you see the old hag, hopefully the beautiful woman. I just wrote about that in my Psychology Today blog because it reminds me of when you get together with a partner and you see a strength of theirs that you really love, right? So in the beginning of the relationship, you know, with James being a philosopher, I loved his analytical mind and deliberate, slow thinking. He'd help me think through things. Years into it, I'm like, you're driving me crazy. You know, I think he's trying to deliberately slow me down and be this persnickety philosopher. I could think that, but knowing that like a top strength of his is analytical thinking, when I look at our relationship and my spouse through a lens of positivity, I realize, no, he's being James and he's leading with his strength. He's not trying to annoy me, but you know, that's a strength of his and that's how he sees things.
Yeah. So we haven't actually, I don't think we used the phrase positive psychology yet, but a lot of what you're talking about is some of the core tenets of this newer field in psychology called positive psychology. I know that many of the listeners of this podcast are big fans of positive psychology, but some might not be that aware with it. James, you're one of the leaders. When I say one of the leaders, I mean like one of the leaders of this newer field. Could you please talk a little bit about it and maybe talk a little about the program that you run at Penn on applied positive psychology?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So thanks, Scott. You know, it's great to be talking to another one of the leaders. So it's great to connect about this. You could answer this question just as well or better than I. But the way I like to describe positive psychology is that mainstream psychology focuses on what's wrong with people and how to fix it, which is important. And positive psychology focuses on what's right with people and how to cultivate it, which is also important and I think usually a lot more fun. And so this field was started about 20 years ago now. Martin Seligman was the person who most responsible for launching this when he was president of the American Psychological Association in 1998. And the field really took off. And about 5 years later, I had met him at the first public meeting on positive psychology that happened in Washington, D.C. in 2000. And a few years after that, he started the Positive Psychology Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And he wanted to start a master's program called Master of Applied Positive Psychology Program to bring in people from all around the world in all kinds of professional pursuits. So doctors, lawyers, educators, business people, and so on, who wanted to study the research in positive psychology and then take it back to their professions and apply it. So he invited me to come and join him at the University of Pennsylvania. And we co-developed and co-launched this program, which I now direct and we both teach in. We now are 13 years later. We have some 500 students who've come through the program from about 25 or 30 different countries around the world.
Yeah, it's such an incredible sense of community, that program. And these people, they become lifelong friends.
It really is, Scott. I just, a few minutes ago, left. We have weekend classes once a month, face-to-face. And so people come in from across the United States, from around the world, for that face-to-face meeting, monthly meeting. And then we have a distance learning modules in the intervening times. And I have to tell you, the connection, the feeling, I mean, we laugh together, we cry together. It's really an extraordinary group of people who are brought together, such diversity, but brought together by the common goal of wanting to learn about the research and practice in positive psychology and take it back into their professional domains. And so really to expand this, you know, we're living in a time when community can be really hard to come by and people feel so separated and isolated and split off from other people. And so I think one of the things, to my mind, that's so special about positive psychology, in addition to the emphasis on the research, is what can happen, the magic that can happen, as Marty Seligman likes to call it, the magic of math that happens when you come together and you're actually putting into practice.
Now, does the techniques of positive psychology, does it ever give a little spark of love for anyone in the program? Does that ever happen? Well, do any marriages ever come out of that?
You know, it actually has. So there have been two pairs of former students who have now gotten married.
Oh.
So Amy and Reb Rebeli, they now have two kids. And then just this past November, there were a couple of alumni, David Yaden and Bit Smith, who got married. So they asked me to be the celebrant for the wedding. It was a gorgeous wedding in New Orleans. And it was it's just a meaningful time and a great opportunity. We were able to use principles from our book in conducting the wedding.
Yeah, and I had the privilege of being there. And watching that, it really was beautiful. I definitely teared up and yeah. So, okay. So clearly positive psychology, you know, kind of, it's not antithetical. It's conducive to cultivating relationships and even romantic relationships. And you make that clear. Something that is also unique about this book is kind of your philosophical background and bringing Aristotle to the table of this. Can you talk a little about what Aristotle thought about relationships and how do you integrate that with positive psychology?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I would imagine that when people, you know, pick up a book on relationships and positive psychology, they don't necessarily expect to start with Aristotle. So it's a good thing to explain. First of all, as you know, Aristotle had a lot of great ideas that actually form a lot of the theoretical basis for positive psychology, in terms of his virtue ethics and so forth, strengths and so forth. One of the things Aristotle wrote is that there are three things that human beings love. We love what's useful, we love what's pleasurable, and we love what's good. And he said there are friendships that go with each of those things that we love. So we have friendships with people who are useful to us. Think about, you know, two friends getting together and starting a company and making a ton of money. That's great. Or two friends who get together and go out in the town on the weekend and have a ton of fun. Aristotle says there's nothing wrong with these types of friendships. You know, they're great if you can have them. But there's a third kind of relationship that's even more powerful. And that's a relationship of virtue or character. And that's when you're attracted to the other person, not because what you can get out of the relationship or merely enjoyment or pleasure from it, but because you see the good in the other person's character. And you are inspired by that to want to become a better person yourself. And so this is a set of concepts from Aristotle that have been very impressive to me. And Susie took those ideas in a very interesting direction.
So on our honeymoon, we were talking about Aristotle and the Nicomachean Ethics, because doesn't everyone talk about that on their honeymoon?
When you're married, James.
Now you know why I love Susie. She was willing to talk about the Nicomachean Ethics on her honeymoon, you know?
So after I was like, why's your suitcase like extra? We have to pay all this money when we unpacked in our honeymoon room. James had about 2,000 books.
Take books on your honeymoon. Come
you
on.
Take books? Well, beach reading, yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed
beach
to be
reading these big thick tomes, well, you know.
The books that he uses from the 16th century they're not on Kindle. They're not on Kindle.
Yeah, you don't want to take the scrolls with you; they could get damaged in transit. Yeah.
So, as we were talking about Aristotle, James likes to talk about the Aristotelian friendship he talks about in class with his students, and he has students pick someone to be their Aristotelian friend throughout the year to help support them with their, you know, work and have somebody to communicate with and, you know, like a buddy. So I said to James on the beach, why did Aristotle have to just limit this to friends? Friendship. What if we took this one step further and we applied it to our relationship? So rather than just being your basic lovers, we became Aristotelian lovers, and we really worked hard about helping one another identify our strengths, seeing the good in one another, and making it a goal of our marriage to really focus on helping, you know, grow the goodness and the character and achieving goals together that focused on each other becoming a better person. And he said, I love that idea. And that's sort of how it happened. So when this book came about, my whole thing was I was never looking to write a book. I was never looking to write a book on relationships. So what did I do? I wrote a book on relationships with my husband. I only wanted to do a book if we could get Aristotle in. And James can tell you, I fought to get Aristotle. Like, Aristotle's not going to get edited out, because I thought this concept, I had never seen a relationship book that had as its sort of foundation, if you will, seeing the goodness in your partner and then using positive psychology as the mechanism or the means to achieve that goodness.
Yeah, and it dovetails so nicely with the writings about love in the humanistic psychology tradition that I'm a big fan of. And Maslow talked about self-actualizing love was all about helping to grow each other. So put Maslow at the same dinner table with James, Susie, and Aristotle.
No, absolutely, Scott. Look, one of the things that we realized in writing this book is that there's just such a proliferation of material that we could use, much more than we could ever put into a single volume. So this isn't intended to be the exhaustive last word on the subject, but a first kind of a beginning.
What's a good
word? There is so much that people have thought about this self-actualization or this helping each other to actualize, looking at the good, focusing on that, and so forth. But again, one of our concerns is that in our culture, those voices, the volume isn't turned up very high on those voices. And we don't really hear that message as much as I think we really need to.
Absolutely. And your book really does a good job of bringing that more into the mainstream. I thought we could maybe talk about practical tips without giving it away. You know, we still want people to buy the book, right?
But we're happy to give practical tips away. The point of all of this is really the message that we want, you know, that we want to get through. When Susie suggested that we write this book, again, neither one of us 10 years ago, neither one of us would have predicted that we'd be, you know, in this position of having written a book on relationships. When she suggested that we do this, my number one reason for saying yes was that I thought of it as an important project that the two of us could undertake that could help us in our own relationship. So the point about the relationship gym, that's not something that we built and hope that people will go to. That's something we need, and we want to be there. And we want to invite other people, you know, to join us. And so it's really about our own relationships, a relationship, and also inviting others and hoping that we can have a community of folks who are interested in this information. So it's really about getting that message across however we can. We're happy to share tips that could be helpful with people.
Thank you. Thank you. How about, should we start with gratitude, the practice of gratitude?
Let's start with gratitude, yeah.
Because, you know, that's a kind of a buzzword these days. And some people might think that's like, you know, why do you need a book to say that gratitude is important? But tell me your twist to it.
Well, we could start with there's so much on gratitude out there. And the majority of the research seems to be on expressing gratitude, which of course is very important. There's not as much, or there's barely any, on the importance of receiving gratitude. And when you're in a relationship, doesn't have to be a romantic relationship, just a dyad. There's two people, right? So there's the giving and the receiving component. And so when we were giving our romance and research workshops and talking to people, experiential and our own marriage, we realized just as important as to give gratitude well, express it well, if it falls on kind of rocky ground and it's not received well, it's like giving a gift and you don't open the present, then it doesn't work. So in our book, we talk about the response being just as important. And we use a metaphor of the gratitude dance, because like dancing, which we've done together, we talk about the ballroom dancing lessons we took. It really takes two people. And if you're not responding well to the one person's moves, the dance isn't going to happen.
Well, so let's do some role play.
Okay.
With it. So Susie, I really like that shirt you're wearing.
This whole thing.
So if I give a compliment to somebody, I don't do it because I want them to feel awkward or just kind of like, that was me, so thanks, right? She didn't respond in a way that I can, you know, do anything with, right? And it really shuts me down. And I don't, it's not fun.
It really shuts him down.
Or, you know, another thing I could say, hey, Susie, I really like that shirt.
Oh, I really like your pants.
So this is the hot potato, right? So it's, I've paid you a compliment. Man, you better pay me back. Otherwise, you know, you're going to owe me.
And it's like, I'm not comfortable with it for some reason, you know? And I thought of the childhood game of hot potato where you throw it back or you're going to get burned. Like, why is that? We toss them all back and forth. It's like, I don't want it. You have it. And you're, so it doesn't really land on, you know, either person.
A third one that your listeners might resonate with. Susie, that was a really delicious dinner you made. Thank you so much for taking the time to do that for us.
I ran out of the spice. I didn't have the right space. The spice, and then I overboiled the potatoes because I had to answer the phone, and then I bought a different rice brand, and I realized it was chewier than the other one.
At this point, Scott, I'm just like, shoot me now. Like, I was just thanking you for the dinner, right? I don't want to hear this whole litany of reasons why I'm an idiot for thinking it was a good dinner.
Yeah, when it
wasn't, right? So I'm making a note to myself, never, ever thank Susie for the dinner again.
Yeah.
Because I don't think it in this whole litany of things. But, so those are some different common ways in which I think people respond to gratitude in ways that really shut the dance of gratitude down.
And it's just like a bad habit. Like, that's a true story, and we have it in our book. You know, the Italian in me, I want to be a good cook like my family was. So I would always give him, like, detailed discounting. We call it discounting in the book. Not, like, coming clean, like, having to tell him why the meal wasn't as good as it could have been, and I didn't realize that was really shutting him down, and he would get so annoyed. And it's funny because when we talked about this to our workshop attendees, so many people identified, men and women, where they had to come clean and they couldn't accept it, the gratitude, because they felt that, you know, it wasn't perfect and they made some mistakes, and it really isn't good for a relationship. It doesn't help build the bond, but rather usually annoys and frustrates the other person.
I think a lot of us find, and a lot of the workshop participants reported, that it's almost like we feel like gratitude is, you know, a plate of cookies. And if you take one of the cookies, you accept the gratitude, it's like there's not going to be enough for everybody else. So you feel kind of guilty for taking that in and accepting it, right? Which, of course, is ridiculous. Gratitude isn't limited, you know, like a plate full of cookies is.
I love that. We should just leave that hanging there, that Susie, that all Susie does is complain.
So if you want to get the tips, you can buy the book. I'm positive ways to receive it.
No,
you
let's
don't
get Susie.
Do those things.
Yeah, but we don't want the listener, you know, think getting the wrong impression, because Susie's one of the most positive individuals I've ever met in my life.
That's right.
So we don't want them getting the wrong impression of Susie. So let's have Susie respond how she would actually respond.
Yeah, so just like we have identified some ways that, that we think kind of shut down the gratitude dance, so we've identified some ways that we think actually help to continue it, right? So I might now, I'll just use the same example. Susie, that was a wonderful dinner that you prepared for us. It was delicious. Thank you so much for taking time to do that.
You're welcome.
So if she responds, she just accepts it. She just takes it. Then that's a start. And I don't have to listen to all the litany of all the things that went wrong with it. It's just, I know that it landed, she understood it, and she accepted it. So accepting is one thing. And again, a lot of us find that it's, you know, hard to accept gratitude, but it's an important part of that dyadic continuation of the relationship. A further step we might take is not just accepting, but really amplifying it. So letting the other person know how we feel when we receive that from them. So if I were to say, Susie, thank you so much for taking the time to prepare this delicious meal. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for noting that. I really appreciate, you know, I worked hard on that and I'm happy you enjoyed it. Thanks for sharing that with me, James.
Great. So, you know, it doesn't take necessarily all that long, but it lets me know that it really matters to her, that it really makes a difference to her, right? So again, you know, or there'll be times when I'll do various things around the house or the kitchen. And if she never responds to me, then it's hard to know how she's feeling about it, right? But if she says, you know, when I see you doing those things, it really makes me feel like you care and you're engaged and so on, then that's great. And then a third step we might mention is then when we can actually move beyond the accepting and the amplification, the savoring it, to advancing the relationship as a result of it, right? So we oftentimes think of gratitude as a kind of, you know, a statement, but really we can think of it as a doorway. And when we accept the gratitude, it's like, you know, seeing the doorway. Mm-hmm. When we amplify it and really savor it, it's like opening the door and looking out to the vista that's outside. And then when we advance the relationship through it, it's like actually walking through the doorway and having so much more in the relationship available to us.
Do you want to give an advancement example?
Sure. So can we use the same one?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So if I said, you know, again, Susie, thank you so much for making this food. I really appreciate you creating this delicious dinner for us.
Thanks, James. Well, can you tell me, like, specifically, what did you really enjoy about it? Was there
the fact that you made this casserole, it reminds me of the casserole that my mom used to make. And, you know, when I was a kid growing up, it just brings back all the nostalgia of, you know, that experience. And so the fact that you got that recipe from my mom and made it, it really makes me feel warm inside.
Oh, I'm so great to hear that. So you see, I mean, we could continue for a while. And the doorway metaphor, I think, is really beautiful. You can see the poetic side of James. I like to also think of it as gratitude, instead of just being transactional, it could be more interactional, and you have upward spirals of positive emotion where we're going deeper. And now James is opening up to me and telling me about childhood experiences, and we could really, you know, have a more authentic connection than just a basic transaction.
Yeah, it reminds me of the work of the Arons on self-expansion and the 36 questions.
You know, yeah.
There you go.
They get more and more deeper. That's great.
Yeah.
Can we talk about passion for a second? Because that's a big one with relationships. A lot of people talk about how passion wanes and then they freak out when that happens. They're like, it's over. It's over. Now, can you maybe calm people down a little bit? You know, that maybe that's not the end of the world, or there are things they can do?
I think that's a great question. And again, I think when you look at pop culture, you know, when you hear about these hot and heavy romances and you have fragrances named Obsession and you have, you know, song titles, I Can't Live Without You and You're My Everything. So people think and expect that that kind of all-consuming, swept away feeling is ideal in a relationship. And the minute that it wanes, then the relationship dies. And there's a lot of problems with that. I mean, the first one is that often the way passion is presented in pop culture and in the media is in that way, which is more of an obsessive passion. So Bob Ballarund, who's the leading passion researcher, talks about there's two types. So there's the obsessive, which I just explained, and then there's a healthier passion, where you maintain your identity. You don't have to be with the other person, but you want to be with the person. So unfortunately, a lot of people are in relationships that may be obsessive, and then they fall apart, and then they get in another relationship, and it falls apart, and they get in another relationship, and they're like, what's going on? Because it's the wrong kind of passion. It's not a healthy passion. Do you want to jump in here?
Well, yeah, so I'd say that, you know, paradoxically, Scott, if people find the passion, quote unquote, waning, that can actually be a good sign. What can be a problem is if that initial feeling of all-consumingness about a relationship never wanes, that's actually an indicator that you may not be in love, you may be in obsession, right? So the healthy kind of way of living life is not to get obsessed with any one particular portion of it, Vadimal's work indicates, but rather to have, as Susie, so this harmonious, this balance, right? And so now, when you first meet somebody, it's certainly natural to be, you know, you're thinking about driving along the highway because it's a new powerful thing in your life. And so we're not saying that romance is bad, but we're saying that the natural progression of a relationship would be that then you are able to integrate that person into your life and vice versa in concert with the other healthy passions that you have. And if you can't do that, and if you're just stuck at that level of, I can't live without you, that may be a warning sign.
And the research actually shows people in relationships, women in relationships with men who are obsessively passionate towards them are less sexually satisfied.
Both partners are less satisfied?
The women are women in relationships with men who are obsessively passionate towards them, the women report being less sexually satisfied.
Interesting.
I don't know. Yeah.
You know, I think that the obsessive passion, and I imagine that would work the other way around as well. When you have someone with a really anxious attachment style, which I think is going to be correlated with obsessive passion, you're going to find it kind of freaks the partner out, no matter male or female.
It's such a great question, because when I was interviewing Bob Ballarin for the book, I'm really into attachment styles, and that was exactly what I predicted. And I said to Bob, I'm curious. I would think that this is, an unhealthy attachment style, the anxious or the avoidant. And he said, I think so too. And they're currently conducting research on that right now as we speak.
Well, it's got to be the case. I mean, you know, it's almost like, how could that not be the case?
Right.
There's a correlation there.
Right.
Because you do find that anxious attachment style is correlated with less sexual satisfaction. That you find that as well. So I'm linking those literatures together. Makes a lot of sense.
Indeed.
Yeah. And one good tip, Bob said in our interviews, that listen to your friends, those friends you trust, because in the research it shows that your friends can usually see the signs of obsessive passion, the red flags, before you do. So maybe some of us had friends, or maybe it was ourselves in the relationship where, you know, you get in a relationship with someone and then suddenly, let's say your friend does, and then suddenly, you know, your friend kind of seems different. He or she's not the same person they used to. They're not still engaged in the activities and interests they used to be since they met someone. You don't recognize them anymore. And that's one of the telltale signs that they could be in an obsessively passionate relationship.
Good, good. I like that. Yeah, often, like when you're so in it, it can be really hard to see a bigger picture. Both couples. You know, or even like a therapist, not just a friend, but like a counselor or something can probably see things, right?
Definitely. So, I mean, we can talk about some healthy ways to your point about the anxious attachment styles too. A lot of it is, you know, ego-based. So if somebody's only focused on, you know, they're insecure and focused on their ego, obviously the other person's probably not going to be as satisfied in bed. So they talk about for harmonious passion to maintain or to develop a healthy passion, try to diversify your interests. So you have your partner, great. But what are those other activities that you enjoyed before the relationship? You know, maybe you enjoyed hiking on the weekends, or your bridge class, or your book club, or some sort of, you know, pickup basketball game. What were those activities? What were the friends you spent time with? And make sure you carve out time to do those things. Because the research shows you can't be obsessively passionate over a bunch of things. There's just not enough time in the day.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, even polyamorous individuals who have multiple partners, because that's a thing too, and I'd imagine you'd want to apply your research to that community as well. You still can't, you know, there's still a limit with...
It's not omniamorous, it's polyamorous.
Exactly, exactly. Like, even with that community, I'm sure that they have limits too. It's like, you know, where you start spreading yourself too thin in a way.
Yeah.
You know, cultivate eros. We haven't used that word yet, but it's one of my favorite words. Yeah. Eros is all about growth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is great. Your book is great. I really recommend people go out and get it. And I just want to end here. You know, is there one piece of advice that you most want people to remember about having great relationships?
I think I'd like to say focus on finding and feeding the good in the relationship. And one way to do that is to focus on strengths. So as you know, Scott, in positive psychology, one of the key things are character strengths, specifically how, for the listeners and audience who might not know, researchers have identified 24 character strengths that have been valued across time and cultures. Yeah. And we all have strengths and we have them in varying degrees. And you can find out what your top strengths are for free by going to the VIA website.
I'll put that in the show notes. Yes.
Okay.
I'll put that in the show notes.
Okay. So I guess we'd like to say in the book, one of the highlights, we talk about finding and feeding the good in the other person by knowing your strengths, knowing your partner's strengths, and then working together to help lead with our strengths and help really further practice our strengths in our relationship. You want to jump in and say something, Scott?
No, I'm just saying, wow. Yeah. Do you want to see something, James?
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think that one of the things that's so wonderful about positive psychology is that it helps to give us the language and the perspective and the activities and the ideas for doing that, right? So it's one thing to say, you know, well, you should recognize the good in the other person. That's really important. But what does that mean? Which, again, coming back to the relationship, Jim, you know, it's one thing to say, well, I need to get fit. But what does that mean?
Well, how do you do it?
You're right.
What are the tips? What are the tools?
Exactly. So that means putting your, you know, your bottom down on that bicycle and going for 30 minutes or, you know, lifting these weights and so on. So the specific exercises in positive psychology, like identifying your strengths and so forth, can give us the real specific and helpful how to for accomplishing this.
And we talk about going on strength dates. You can read the book and learn about that. But again, I think to James's point, then there's a practical component. Because you could say, well, focus on the good. Okay, what's the tangible? So we like using these wonderful character strengths because everybody has character strengths, right? You don't have to go out and buy some new equipment.
Right.
You're working on character strengths. And you could come up, use your imagination. Hopefully everybody has some creativity, even though it's not, if it's not a top strength like it is for you, Scott, that you can be creative and work with your partner on injecting some novelty in your life by coming up with exercises and dates that focus on your strengths.
Yes. Well, I like that. That's kind of like Esther Perel meets positive psychology.
That's right.
Because she talks about the importance of novelty to keep things exciting, but
right.
she doesn't
that's
talk
right.
about the strengths so much. So that's great. Cool, guys. Well, thanks so much for this chat. And I consider it really exciting and inspiring to talk about this topic with you all. So have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. It was wonderful.
Scott, we have such tremendous respect for you and the work that you're doing. It's a real honor for us to be able to be with you and have this conversation with you. Thank you.
Thanks, James. That means a lot. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.